And good afternoon, Braidwood. It's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading, and we've been reading Nicholas Nickleby by Charles Dickens. But before we go any further with that, a word from the people who help make our station all that it is.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
David! Where are you?
I'm over here behind all the boxes and the old piano.
I really think we need to get rid of some of this junk, don't you?
Junk? It's not junk, woman.
I know. I'll call Braidwood and District Storage. They have a range of storage units and you can access your treasures 24 hours, 7 days a week. Call us today for a quote on 0407 701 788. Braidwood and District Storage, proud sponsors of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Servicemen's Club,
your local friendly club.
Whether you're looking for a round of golf, a delicious meal, or a drink with friends, the Braidwood Servicemen's Club boasts a range of recreational and sporting facilities to cater for every taste.
The restaurant provides Chinese and Australian meals and is open for lunch and dinner Tuesday to Sunday.
Braidwood Servicemen's Club, 4842 2108.
Located on the corner of Coronation Avenue and Victory Street, Braidwood.
A sponsor of
Braidwood FM.
Located on 28 acres of natural bushland beside the pristine Mongalo River, Tombara is conveniently located only 15 minutes drive from the historic town of Braidwood, just over an hour from Canberra and 50 minutes from Batemans Bay. More energetic outdoor options are some wonderful bush walking opportunities or in Braidwood, a round of golf, the Heritage Walk or the Braidwood Art Galleries. You can contact the manager on 0448 533 616. Tom Barra, proud to be a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors who really do support our station. And it's wonderful that so many local and not so local businesses do so. Well, we've been reading Nicholas Nickleby. And we're at the point where young Nicholas is on his way to a school in Yorkshire. They're at the coach and they're almost ready to go. At this moment, when the coachman and guard were comparing notes for the last time before starting on the subject of the waybill, when porters were screwing out the last reluctant sixpences, itinerant newsmen making the last offer of a morning paper, and the horses giving the last impatient rattle to their harness, Nicholas felt somebody pulling softly at his leg. He looked down, and there stood Newman Noggs, who pushed up into his hand a dirty letter. "What's this?" inquired Nicholas. "Hush," rejoined Nog, pointing to Mr. Ralph Nickleby, who was saying a few earnest words to Squeers a short distance off. "You take it, read it. Nobody knows, that's all." "Stop!" cried Nicholas. "No," replied Noggs. Nicholas cried stop again, but Newman Noggs was gone. A minute's bustle, a banging of the coach doors, a swaying of the vehicle to one side as the heavy coachman and still heavier guard climbed into their seats. A cry of, "All right," a few notes from the horn, a hasty glance of two sorrowful faces below, and the hard features of Mr. Ralph Nickleby. And the coach was gone, too, and rattling over the stones of Smithfield. The little boy's legs being too short to admit of their feet resting upon anything as they sat, and the little boy's bodies being consequently in imminent hazard of being jerked off the coach, Nicholas had enough to do, over the stones, to hold them on. Between the manual exertion and the mental anxiety attendant upon this task, he was not a little relieved when the coach stopped at Peacock at Islington. He was still more relieved when a hearty-looking gentleman, with a very good-humoured face and a very fresh colour, got up behind and proposed to take the other corner of the seat. "If we put some of these youngsters in the middle," said the newcomer, "they'll be safer in case of their going to sleep, eh?" If you'll have the goodness, sir," replied Squeers, "that'll be the very thing. Mr. Nickleby, take three of them boys between you and the gentleman. Belling," said Squeers, explaining to the stranger, "books is two." "I have not the least objection, I am sure," said the fresh-coloured gentleman. "Now, I have a brother who wouldn't object to book his six children as two at any butcher's or baker's in the kingdom, I dare say. Far from it." "Oh, six children, sir?" exclaimed Squeers. "Yes, yes, all boys," replied the stranger. "Mr. Nickleby," said Squeers in great haste, "catch hold of that basket. Let me give you a card, sir, of an establishment where those boys can be brought up in an enlightened, liberal and moral manner, with no mistake at all about it, for 20 guineas a year each. 20 guineas, sir. Or do I take all the boys together upon an average right through and say £100 a year for the lot?" "Oh," said the gentleman, glancing at the card, "you are the Mr. Squeers mentioned here, I presume." "Oh, yes, I am, sir," replied the worthy pedagogue. "Mr. Wackford Squeers is my name, and I'm very far from being ashamed of it. These are some of my boys, sir. That's one of my assistants, sir. Mr. Nickleby, a gentleman's son and a good scholar, mathematical, classical and commercial. We don't do things by halves at our shop. All manner of learning my boys take down, sir. The expense is never thought of, and they get paternal treatment and washing in." "Well, upon my word," said the gentleman, glancing at Nicholas with half a smile and a more half expression of surprise, "these are advantages indeed." "Or you may say that, sir," rejoined Squeers, thrusting his hands into his greatcoat pockets. "The most unexceptionable references are given and required. I wouldn't make a reference to any boy that wasn't responsible for the payment of £5.25. No, not if you went down on your knees and asked me with the tears running down your face, would I do it."
Highly considerate," said the passenger.
"Ah, it's my great aim to be considerate, sir," rejoined Squeers. "Snorley, Junior, if you don't leave off chattering your teeth and shaking with the cold, I'll warm you with a severe thrashing in about half a minute's time."
"Sit fast there, gentlemen," said the guard as he clambered up. "All right behind there, Dick," cried the coachman. "All right," was the reply. "Off she goes." And off she did go, if coaches be feminine, amidst a loud flourish from the guard's horn and the calm approval of all the judges of coaches and coach-horses congregated at the Peacock, but more especially of the helpers, who stood with their cloths over their arms, watching the coach till it disappeared, and then lounged admiringly stablewards, bestowing various gruff encomiums on the beauty of the turnout. When the guard, who was a stout old Yorkshireman, had blown himself quite out of breath, he put the horn in a little tunnel of a basket fastened to the coach side for the purpose, and giving himself a plentiful shower of blows on the chest and shoulders, observed it was uncommon cold, after which he demanded of every person separately whether he was going right through, and if not, where he was going. Satisfactory replies being made to these queries, he surmised that the roads were pretty heavy after that fall last night, and took the liberty of asking whether any of them gentlemen carried a snuff-box. It happening that nobody did, he remarked with a mysterious air that he had heard a medical gentleman as went down to Grantham last week say how that snuff-taking was bad for the eyes, but for his part he never found it so, and what he said was that everybody should speak as they found. Nobody attempting to controvert this position, he took a small brown paper parcel out of his hat, and putting on a pair of horn spectacles, the writing being crabbed, read the direction a half a dozen times over, having done which he consigned the parcel to its old place, put up his spectacles again, and stared at everybody in turn.
After this, he took another blow at the horn by way of refreshment, and having now exhausted his usual topics of conversation, folded his arms as well as he could in so many coats, and, falling into solemn silence, he looked carelessly at the familiar objects which met his eye on every side as the coach rolled on. The only things he seemed to care for being horses and droves of cattle, which he scrutinised with a critical air as they were passed upon the road. The weather was intensely and bitterly cold. A great deal of snow fell from time to time, and the wind was intolerably keen. Mr. Squeers got down at almost every stage to stretch his legs, as he said, and he always came back from such excursions with a very red nose, and composed himself to sleep directly. There is reason to suppose that he derived great benefit from the process. The little pupils, having been stimulated with the remains of their breakfast, and further invigorated by sundry small cups of a curious cordial carried by Mr. Squeers, which tasted very like toast and water put into a brandy bottle by mistake, went to sleep, woke, shivered, and cried as their feelings prompted. Nicholas and the good-tempered man found so many things to talk about that, between conversing together and cheering up the boys, the time passed with them as rapidly as it could under such adverse circumstances. So the day wore on. At Eaton Slocum there was a good coach dinner, of which the box, the four front outsides, the one inside, Nicholas, the good-tempered man, and Mr. Squeers partook, while the five little boys were put to thaw by the fire and regaled with sandwiches. A stage or two further on, the lamps were lighted and a great to-do occasioned by the taking up at a roadside inn of a very fastidious lady with an infinite variety of cloaks and small parcels, who loudly lamented, for the behoof of the outsides, the non-arrival of her own carriage, which was to have taken her on, and made the guard solemnly promise to stop every green chariot he saw coming, which, as it was a dark night and he was sitting with his face the other way, that officer undertook with many fervent asseverations to do. Lastly, the fastidious lady, finding there was a solitary gentleman inside, had a small lamp lighted which she carried in her reticule, and after being much trouble shut in, the horses were put into a brisk canter, and the coach once more was in rapid motion. The night and the snow came on together, and dismal enough they were. There was no sound to be heard but the howling of the wind, for the noise of the wheels and the tread of the horses' feet were rendered inaudible by the thick coating of snow which covered the ground and was fast increasing every moment. The streets of Stamford were deserted as they passed through the town, and its old churches rose, frowning and dark, from the whitened ground. 20 miles further on, two of the front outside passengers, wisely availing themselves of their arrival at one of the best inns in England, turned in for the night at the George at Grantham. The remainder wrapped themselves more closely in their coats and cloaks, and leaving the light and warmth of the town behind them, pillowed themselves against the luggage and prepared with many half-suppressed moans again to encounter the piercing blast which swept across the open country. They were little more than a stage out of Grantham, or about halfway between it and Newark, when Nicholas, who had been asleep for a short time, was suddenly roused by a violent jerk which nearly threw him from his seat. Grasping the rail, he found that the coach had sunk greatly on one side, though it was still dragged forward by the horses, and while, confused by their plunging and the loud screams of the lady inside, he hesitated for an instant whether to jump off or not. The vehicle turned easily over and relieved him from all further uncertainty by flinging him to the road. Chapter 6, in which occurrence of the accident mentioned in the last chapter, affords an opportunity to a couple of gentlemen to tell stories against each other. "Whoa!" cried the guard, on his legs in a minute and running to the leaders' heads. "Oi, is there any gentleman there as can lend a horn here? Keep quiet, dang ye, whoa!" What's the matter?" demanded Nicholas, looking sleepily up. "Mother, man, mother, enough for one night," muttered the guard. "Ah, dang the warlight bay. He's gain mad with glory. I think cast to corch, it's over. Here, can't ye lend a horn, dummit? I'd have been dean if all my bones were broken." "Here," cried Nicholas, staggering to his feet, "I'm ready. I'm only a little broad, that's all." "Hold 'em tight,"
cried the guard. "While her coat traces, hang on to them somehow. Well, Dean, my lord, that's it. Let them go now. Dang them, they'll gang warm fast enough."
In truth, the animals were no sooner released than they trotted back with much deliberation to the stable they had just left, which was distant not a mile behind.
"Can you blow a horn?" asked the guard, disengaging one of the coach lamps.
"Well, I dare say I can," said Nicholas.
"Aye, then just blow away into that un, as lies on the ground fit to waken the deed. Willie, please, while I stop somewhere it's here squealing inside. I'm coming. Hey, don't make that noise, woman."
As the man spoke, he proceeded to wrench open the uppermost door of the coach, while Nicholas, seizing the horn, woke the echoes far and wide with one of the most extraordinary performances on that instrument ever heard by mortal ears. It had its effect, however, not only in rousing such of the passengers as were recovering from the stunning effects of their fall, but in summoning assistance to their relief, for lights gleamed in the distance and people were already astir. In fact, a man on horseback galloped down before the passengers were well collected together, and a careful investigation being instituted, it appeared that the lady inside had broken her lamp and the gentleman his head, that the two front outsides had escaped with black eyes, the box with a bloody nose, the coachman with a contusion on the temple, Mr. Squeers with a portmanteau bruise on his back, and the remaining passengers without any injury at all. These facts were no sooner thoroughly ascertained than the lady gave several indications of fainting. But being forewarned that if she did, she must be carried on some gentleman's shoulders to the nearest public house, she prudently thought better of it and walked back with the rest. They found on reaching it that it was a lonely place, with no very great accommodation in the way of apartments, that portion of its resources being all comprised in one public room with a sanded floor and a chair or two. However, a large faggot and a plentiful supply of coals being heaped upon the fire, the appearance of things was not long in mending, and by the time they had washed off all effaceable marks of the late accident, the room was warm and light, which was a most agreeable exchange for the cold and darkness out of doors.
"Well, Mr. Nickleby," said Squeers, insinuating himself into the warmest corner, "you did very right to catch and hold them horses. I should have done it myself if I had come in time, but I'm very glad you did it, and you did it well, very well."
"So well," said the merry-faced gentleman, who did not seem to approve very much of the patronising tone adopted by Squeers, "that if they had not been firmly checked when they were, you would most probably have had no brains left to teach with." This remark called up a discourse relative to the promptitude Nicholas had displayed, and he was overwhelmed with the compliments and commendations.
"I'm very glad to have escaped, of course," observed Squeers. "Every man is glad when he escapes from danger. But if any one of my charges had been hurt, oh, if I had been prevented from restoring any one of these little boys to his parents whole and sound as I received him, what would have been my feelings? Why, the wheel atop my head would have been far preferable to it."
"Are they all brothers, sir?" inquired the lady who had carried the Davy or safety lamp.
"Aye, in one sense they are, ma'am," replied Squeers, diving into his great coat pocket for cards. "Oh, they are all under the same parental and affectionate treatment. Mrs. Squeers and myself are a mother and a father to every one of them. Mr. Nickleby, hand the lady them cards and offer these to the gentleman. Perhaps they might know of some parents that would be glad to avail themselves of the establishment."
Expressing himself to this effect, Mr. Squeers, who lost no opportunity of advertising gratuitously, placed his hands upon his knees and looked at the pupils with as much benignity as he could possibly affect, while Nicholas, blushing with shame, handed round the cards as directed.
"I hope you suffered no inconvenience from the overturn, ma'am," said the merry-faced gentleman, addressing the fastidious lady as though he were charitably desirous to change the subject.
"No bodily inconvenience," replied the lady.
"No mental inconvenience, I would hope."
The subject is a very painful one to my feelings, sir," replied the lady with strong emotion, and I beg you as a gentleman not to refer to it."
"Oh, dear me," said the merry-faced gentleman, looking merrier still. "I merely intended to inquire..."
"I hope no inquiries will be made,"
said the lady, or I shall be compelled to throw myself on the protection of the other gentleman. Landlord, pray direct a boy to keep watch outside the door, and if a green chariot passes in the direction of Grantham, stop it instantly. The people of the house were evidently overcome by this request, and when the lady charged the boy to remember as a means of identifying the expected green chariot that it would have a coachman with a gold-laced hat on the box and a footman, most probably in silk stockings, behind, the attentions of the good woman of the inn were redoubled. Even the box passenger caught the infection and, growing wonderfully deferential, immediately inquired whether there was not very good society in that neighbourhood, to which the lady replied yes, there was, in a manner which sufficiently implied that she moved at the very tip-top and summit of it all. "As the guard has gone on horseback to Grantham to get another coach," said the good-tempered gentleman, when they had all been sitting around the fire for some time in silence, "and as he must be gone a couple of hours at the very least, I propose a bowl of hot punch. What say you, sir?" The question was addressed to the broken-headed inside, who was a man of very genteel appearance, dressed in mourning. He was not past middle age, but his hair was grey. It seemed to have been prematurely turned by care or sorrow. He readily acceded to the proposal and appeared to be prepossessed by the frank good nature of the individual from whom it emanated. This latter personage took upon himself the office of tapster when the punch was ready, and after dispensing it all round, led the conversation to the antiquities of York, with which both he and the grey-haired gentleman appeared to be well acquainted. When this topic flagged, he turned with a smile to the grey-headed gentleman and asked if he could sing. "I cannot indeed," replied the gentleman, smiling in his turn. "That's a pity," said the owner of the good-humoured countenance. "Is there nobody here who can sing a song to lighten the time?" The passengers, one and all, protested that they could not, that they wished they could, and that they couldn't remember the words of anything without the book, and so forth. "Perhaps the lady would not object," said the president, with great respect and a merry twinkle in his eye. "Some little Italian thing out of the last opera brought into town would be most acceptable, I'm sure." As the lady condescended to make no reply, but tossed her head contemptuously, the murmured some further expression of surprise regarding the absence of the green chariot, one or two voices urged upon the president himself the propriety of making an attempt for the general benefit. "Oh, I would if I could," said he of the good-tempered face, "for I hold that in this, as in all other cases, where people who are strangers to each other are thrown unexpectedly together, they should endeavour to render themselves pleasant for the joint sake of the little community, if possible." "I wish the maxim were more generally acted on in all cases," said the grey-headed gentleman. "I'm sorry to hear it," returned the other. "Perhaps you can't sing, would you tell us a story?" "Oh, nay, I'd ask you." "Oh, after you, I will with pleasure." "Indeed," said the grey-haired gentleman, smiling. "Well, let it be so. I fear the turn of my thoughts is not calculated to lighten the time you must pass here. But you have brought this upon yourselves and shall judge. We were speaking of York Minster just now. My story shall have some reference to it. Let us call it The Five Sisters of York. After a murmur of approbation from the other passengers, during which the fastidious lady drank a glass of punch unobserved, the grey-headed gentleman thus went on. "A great many years ago, for the 15th century was scarce 2 years old at the time, and King Henry IV sat upon the throne of England, there dwelt in the ancient city of York five maiden sisters, the subjects of my tale. These five sisters were all of surpassing beauty. The eldest was in her 23rd year, the second a year younger, the third a year younger than the second, and the fourth a year younger than the third. They were tall, stately, every movement, and the fame of their beauty it spread through all the country round, with their beautiful figures, dark flashing eyes, and hair of jet. Dignity and grace were in their every movement. But if the four elder sisters were lovely, how beautiful was the youngest, a fair creature of 16. The blushing tints in the soft bloom of the fruit, or the delicate painting on the flower, are not more exquisite than was the blending of the rose and lily in her gentle face, or the deep blue of her eye. The vine, in all its elegant luxuriance, is no more graceful than were the clusters of rich brown hair that sported round her brow. If we all had hearts like those, which beat so lightly in the bosoms of the young and the beautiful, what a heaven this earth would be. If, while our bodies grow old and withered, our hearts could but retain their early youth and freshness, or what avail would be our sorrows and sufferings? But the faint image of Eden, which is stamped upon them in childhood, chafes and rubs in our rough struggles with the world, and soon wears away, too often to leave nothing but a mournful blank remaining. The heart of this fair girl bounded with joy and gladness. Devoted attachment to her sisters and a fervent love of all beautiful things in nature were its pure affections. Her gleesome voice and merry laugh were the sweetest music of their home. She was its very light and life. The brightest of flowers in the garden were reared by her. The caged birds sang when they heard her voice and pined when they missed its sweetness. Alice, dear Alice, what living thing within the sphere of her gentle witchery could fail to love her? You may seek in vain now for the spot on which these sisters lived, for their very names have passed away, and dusty antiquaries tell of them as a fable. But they dwelt in an old wooden house, old even in those days, with overhanging gables and balconies of rudely carved oak, which stood within a pleasant orchard and was surrounded by a rough stone wall, whence a stout archer might have winged an arrow to St. Mary's Abbey. The old abbey flourished then, and the five sisters, living on its fair domains, paid yearly dues to the black monks of St. Benedict, to which fraternity it belonged. It was a bright and sunny morning in the pleasant time of summer when one of those black monks emerged from the abbey portal and bent his steps towards the house of the fair sisters. Heaven above was blue and the earth beneath was green. The river glistened like a path of diamonds in the sun. The birds poured forth their songs from the shady trees, and the lark soared high above the waving corn, and the deep buzz of insects filled the air. Everything looked gay and smiling, but the holy man walked gloomily on, with his eyes bent on the ground. The beauty of the earth is but a breath, and man is but a shadow. What sympathy should a holy preacher have with either? With eyes bent upon the ground then, or raised only enough to prevent his stumbling over such obstacles as lay in his way, the religious man moved slowly forward until he reached a small postern in the wall of the sisters' orchard, through which he passed, closing it behind him. The noise of soft voices in conversation and of merry laughter fell upon his ears ere he had advanced many paces, and raising his eyes higher than was his humble wont, he descried at no great distance the five sisters seated on the grass with Alice in the centre, all busily plying their customary task of embroidering.
"Save you, fair daughters," said the friar, and fair in truth they were.
Even a monk might have loved them as choice masterpieces of his maker's hand. The sisters saluted the holy man with becoming reverence, and the eldest motioned him to a mossy seat beside them, but the good friar shook his head and bumped himself down on a very hard stone, at which no doubt approving angels were gratified.
"Ye were merry, daughters," said the monk.
"You know how light of heart and sweet Alice is," replied the eldest sister, passing her fingers through the tresses of the smiling girl. "And what joy and cheerfulness it wakes up within us to see all nature beaming in brightness and sunshine, father," added Alice, blushing beneath the stern look of the recluse. The monk answered not, save by a grave inclination of the head, and the sisters pursued their task in silence.
"Still wasting the precious hours," said the monk at length, turning to the eldest sister as he spoke. "Still wasting the precious hours on this vain trifling. Alas, alas, that the few bubbles on the surface of eternity, all that heaven wills we should see of that dark, deep stream, should be so lightly scattered."
"Father," urged the maiden, pausing, as did each of the others in her busy task, We have prayed at matins, our daily alms have been distributed at the gate, the sick peasants have been tended, all our morning tasks have been performed. I hope our occupation is a blameless one.
See here, said the friar, taking the frame from her hand, an intricate winding of gaudy colours, without purpose or object, unless it be that one day it is destined for some vain ornament to minister to the pride of your frail and giddy sex. Day after day has been employed upon this senseless task, and yet it is not half accomplished. The shade of each departed day falls upon our graves, and the worm exults as he beholds it. To know that we are hastening thither, daughters, is there no better way to pass the fleeting hours?
The four elder sisters cast down their eyes, as if abashed by the holy man's reproof. But Alice raised hers, and bent them mildly on the friar.
Oh, dear mother, said the maiden, heaven rest her soul.
Amen,
said the friar in a deep voice.
Our dear mother, faltered the fair Alice, was living when these long tasks began, and bade us, when we should be no more, she should be no more, ply them in all discretion and cheerfulness, in our leisure hours. She said that if in harmless mirth and maidenly pursuits we passed those hours together, they would prove the happiest and most peaceful of our lives, and that if in later times we went forth into the world and mingled with its cares and trials, if allured by its temptations and dazzled by its glitter, we ever forgot that love and duty which should bind in holy ties the children of one loved parent, a glance at the old work of our common girlhood would awaken good thoughts of bygone days and soften our hearts to affection and love.
Alice speaks truly, father, said the elder sister somewhat proudly, and so saying she resumed her work as did the others. It was a kind of sampler of large size that each sister had before her. The device was of a complex and intricate description, and the pattern and colours of all five were the same. The sisters bent gracefully over their work, the monk resting his chin upon his hands, looked from one to the other in silence.
How much better, he said at length, to shun all such thoughts and chances, and in the peaceful shelter of the church devote your lives to heaven. Infancy, childhood, the prime of life and old age, wither us as rapidly as they crowd upon each other. Think how human dust rolls onward to the tomb, and turning your faces steadily towards that goal, avoid the cloud which takes its rise among the pleasures of the world, and cheats the senses of their votaries. The veil, daughters, the veil!
Never, sisters, cried Alice. Barter not the light and air of heaven, and the freshness of earth, and all the beautiful things which breathe upon it, for the cold cloister and the cell. Nature's own blessings are the proper goods of life, and we may share them sinlessly together. To die is our heavy portion, but, oh, let us die with life about us. When our cold hearts cease to beat, let warm hearts be beating near. Let our last look be upon the bounds which God has set to his own bright skies, and not on stone walls and bars of iron. Dear sisters, let us live and die, if you list, in this green garden's compass. Only shun the gloom and sadness of a cloister, and we shall be happy.
The tears fell fast from the maiden's eyes, as she closed her impassioned appeal, and hid her face in the bosom of her sister.
Take comfort, Alice, said the eldest, kissing her fair forehead. The veil will never cast a shadow on thy young brow.
How say you, sisters? For yourselves you speak, and not for Alice or for me. The sisters with one accord cried that their lot was cast together, and that there were dwellings for peace and virtue beyond the convent's walls.
Father, said the eldest lady, rising with dignity, you hear our final resolve. The same pious care which enriched the Abbey of St. Mary and left us, orphans, to its holy guardianship, directed that no constraint should be imposed upon our inclinations, but that we should be free to live according to our choice.
Let us hear no more of this, we pray you. Sisters, it is nearly noon. Let us take shelter until evening. With a reverence to the friar, the lady rose and walked towards the house, hand in hand with Alice, and the other sisters followed. The holy man, who had often urged the same point before, but had never met with so direct a repulse, walked some little distance behind, with his eyes bent upon the earth and his lips moving as if in prayer. As the sisters reached the porch, he quickened his pace and called upon them to stop.
"Stay,"
said the monk, raising his right hand in the air and directing an angry glance by turns at Alice and the older sister.
"Stay, and hear from me what these recollections are which you would cherish above eternity, and awaken if in mercy they slumbered by means of idle toys. The memory of earthly things is charged in afterlife with bitter disappointment, affliction, death, with a dreary change and wasting sorrow. The time will one day come when a glance at those unmeaning baubles will tear open deep wounds in the hearts of some among you and strike to your innermost souls. When that hour arrives, and mark me, come it will, turn from the world to which you clung, to the refuge which you spurned. Find me the cell which shall be colder than the fire of mortals grows, when dimmed by calamity and trial, and there weep for the dreams of youth. These things are heaven's will, not mine," said the friar, subduing his voice as he looked around upon the shrinking girls. "The Virgin's blessing be upon you, daughters." And with these words he disappeared through the postern, and the sisters hastening into the house were seen no more that day. But nature will smile, though priests may frown, and the next day the sun shone brightly, and on the next again, and in the morning's glare and in the evening's soft response, the five sisters still walked, or worked, or beguiled the time by cheerful conversation in their quiet orchard. Well, that's our book reading for today. What an interesting... Well, I've seen some wet blankets in my life, but that priest's really something. Ah, dearie me. Anyway, we'll see how the story ends, and then there's another story to follow called The Baron of Grozzewalk, I think it's called, which will be told by the man with the merry countenance. I hope you're enjoying Nicholas Nickleby, and may you have a good week, and take care.